Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Frank Film Club, the club for lovers and makers of film. I'm Maisie Williams. I am an actor and producer.
I'm Lowry Roberts, and I'm a filmmaker and producer.
Hello, I'm Hannah Williams, and I am a casting director.
And welcome to our club. Take one.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Frank Film Club. I'm Lowry. This episode, we're going to be talking about Save the Last Dance, which was directed by Thomas Carter, written by Cheryl Edwards, Dwayne Adler, and starring Julia Stiles, Sean Patrick Thomas, Kerry Washington, and Bianca Lawson. But before we get into everything, girls, how are you?
What have I been up to? I had COVID.
Boo.
Oh, no. It finally got you.
I had COVID. Yeah, finally got me, and it was weird, because when I got my positive test, I was, like, weirdly like, oh my god, how exciting, I've got it. Yeah. And then I felt awful, and it wasn't as exciting, but it's done now, and it means I won't get it for at least another 6 weeks or whatever, so you'll catch me on the town. What about you, Han? What have you been up to?
No COVID. I had a horrible cold. Boring. But then I've just been spending loads of time out of the house the last couple of weeks. Like, we've had stuff on every night. Theatre, shows, talks, classes, stuff going on. And now I've forgotten what my boyfriend looks like. But it's been really nice.
Love that. Yeah. That's so good.
Yeah. Make it up for lost time.
Yeah, the world is officially open, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been loving it. And you've been doing the same, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been busy. Been out and about. I'm currently in London town. Went to a wedding last weekend where I did a bit of hula hooping on the dance floor. It was great. Now I've got a hula hoop.
Well, you stole it and took it home. Thank you.
That is brilliant.
Yeah, hilarious. Who knew that it's such a workout? Well, let's get to it. So, quick overview on Save the Last Dance if you haven't seen it. It was released in 2001 and it follows the story of Sarah, played by Julia Stiles, a white girl who moves to Chicago to live with her father after her mother dies in a car accident. Whilst there, Sarah, previously a ballet dancer, quickly finds herself as an outcast in the all-black school that she attends, where she ends up falling for Derek, played by Sean Patrick Thomas, and becomes fast friends with his sister, Chenille, played by Kerry Washington. Derek then helps her to reignite her love for dancing following the death of her mother. And she eventually gets into Juilliard, which is an excellent happy ending to the film. You've probably seen this film before, but on this watch, what were your initial thoughts?
What a one to return to. I feel like I watched this film so many times. I was really into dance films when I was younger, and I would watch them on repeat, and this was one of them. It was just really interesting to revisit a film that is just so obviously like late 90s, early noughties. The structure, the tone, the acting was, yeah, just so indicative of that time, I feel. And it was really soothing to watch, but yeah, very different this time.
Yeah, again, this film is like part of my origin story. But however, the question is, what did I think this time? Actually, I think that it's like not a great film. But it's fine because it was really enjoyable and I got a lot from it. And we'll dive into it. But really, if I watched this film for the first time now, I would think that it's not a very good movie.
I obviously thought I had seen this film before because everyone has and I've heard about it so much. But then on watching it, realised that I don't think I have seen this film before.
Oh.
I think I just thought that I had. And then I was like, I actually have no recollection of any of these scenes. Because I wasn't remembering any of the scenes, it wasn't like bringing back fond memories or anything. So I was seeing it completely with like a fresh mind and was a bit like, ooh, questionable at times. I'd say the only thing that felt nostalgic is like listening to the soundtrack, because a lot of the songs, I definitely already knew a lot of those songs. And so I'm very excited that we're going to be talking with the soundtrack producer later on in the episode.
Yeah, me too. I think that the soundtrack was the strongest part of this, and that was the bit that I found really nostalgic. So yeah, thrilled to be chatting with him because I think it's such an integral part of this movie.
So do you guys remember when you did first watch the film and what was that experience like?
Yeah, I was obsessed with dance films as well, and I was watching Step Up 2, The Streets, and that was the first one that I had chosen myself to watch. And then my sister's like, you know, there's like a Step Up 1. And I was like, what? And so watched that. And then Step Up 3D came out. And then I was with my best friend and she said, you love dancing films so much and you've never seen Save the Last Dance. And I was like, no, like put it on ASAP pronto. And it was amazing. And we sat there and we watched Save the Last Dance. And yeah, it was very, very fond memories. So that was my first viewing.
I was gonna say, right, so maybe not for you, Lowry, but for you, Maze, because you like dance films, I love dance films as well. Step Up, classic. Honey, Jessica Alba, classic.
Yes.
Then this film, I was trying to remember when I was watching it this time, did I think at the time when I was younger, God, she's a good dancer, like God, this is great, like what did I think? And can you remember what you thought?
I think I definitely felt it was very jarring to see someone who was a ballerina do street dancing, because I'd only really watched street dancing films up until that point. But I felt like it was intentional, whereas now, even watching her big comeback performance, her last dance, I felt even the bits that were supposed to be a good comeback, I still found to be a little bit embarrassing to watch this time around. What about you, Han?
I remember at the time thinking, wow, how amazing to see these two worlds collide. But now I think because maybe we have so much diversity and like it's not a thing too much for it to be like that, and like this isn't a, it just seemed a bit contrived and strange. Actually, because I was thinking about the casting of this film when I was watching it, like the Step Up films, I feel like they cast a lot of dancers. And then this, she's not a dancer? I don't know. You tell me, Lowry.
She got cast from this when Thomas Carter, the director, saw her dancing scene in 10 Things I Hate About You. You know, when she's like drunkenly dancing on the table, she recalls him seeing it and going, ooh, you have rhythm.
It's a good scene. I love that scene.
I don't think she did have a ballet background or anything. And I think a lot of ballet people did kick off about that because they were like, she's not a ballet dancer. But it was like, but yeah, she is an actor. You have to have an actor for it as well.
I wonder how much training she had. I also wonder, I was trying to see where the cuts were to see if it was her on certain parts.
Same. I feel like she did a lot of it herself. I did see somewhere that she did like a load of training for it. And then even while they were shooting, one, she was underage, but two, she was like very straight laced and everyone would go out and have loads of fun and go to all these dancing clubs and like the choreographer and like all of the cast, and they'd like go out and she would always not. And even like to this day, she like has FOMO basically, that she like was so hard on herself and was like training so hard to like do all the dancing.
Kind of true to the character though. Like if they're all out having an absolute rave and she's, yeah, being her character.
Yeah.
It worked.
Aw. So who was your favourite character?
Great question. Kerry Washington.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Chenille. I think it's got to be just from the work, like from the moment she first goes on screen, you just can't stop watching her. She's really, really good in this. How much, what has she done before?
She'd done one film before, which was called...
That is mad.
Lanisha Is Our Song. And she was actually working as a substitute teacher at the time. So she was 22 when they started shooting Save the Last Dance. She'd done one film before. So she took off time from her sub-teacher job, shot Save the Last Dance, and went back to being a substitute teacher. So that, but she does say that Save the Last Dance was like the kickoff for her career then.
When you're watching it, like even now, she does just shine in it. And so I love that this is one of the early things because, yeah, she's incredible in it.
You know what? I kind of just wish that she was in it more and it was more about her because I loved her character and her character's like arc. I think that could have been more of a main thing.
I hear that she spent a bit of time where after she got cast with Young Mums to do some research for the role.
She definitely pulled the story in like the best way.
Yeah, she was absolutely brilliant in it. So this was directed by a black director. One of the writers is white, one of the writers is black. However, do you still think it has quite a white gaze perspective?
Well, I wonder if this film, if they created this world in black culture and then thought, what can we do to make this sellable, marketable? And then they centered it around a white character because everything else is not white. And actually, those are the parts of the film that I find so interesting. And I wonder if they did do that.
I don't know, but I just felt like when watching it, I was like, I think this is a sign of the times that it's a kind of a bit of a white hero story. Kerry Washington's character is so brilliant in it. And it's also Bianca Lawson's as well, Derek's ex-girlfriend. Neither of them get that much of a look in. It does, the story does bring up a lot of important topics, but then at the end of the day, it still works out in Julia Stiles' favour. So as much as these topics are brought up, I think it's still quite like white gaze-y, which is probably like producers and financing and how the film industry is and was.
Yeah, maybe it's just what they had to do in order for it to get made, the hoops they had to jump through. But, you know, even doing something like this and being able to tell all of these other stories through it was, like, progressive, you know, of that time, even though we look at it now and think that it's problematic. Like, I think then, even, like, having a chick flick teen film with, like, an interracial couple, I don't know that I've seen anything like that when I was that age.
That's true. Of the time, it's still progressive.
But it does make you think when you watch it back now, just how far I hope that we have come. And yeah, that there is a tinge in there that you do feel a little bit uneasy, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because I was listening to a podcast that was saying about how Derek's character, he really doesn't code switch. So when he's speaking to his friends, he speaks exactly the same as he would to... like the teacher and Julia, and like speaks very differently to how his friend speaks, and they were like they were saying about how it's almost as if they kind of had to make him a bit more of an appropriate character for the white audiences so that it was like okay for Julia to be with, which was like, oh yeah, I hadn't realized that when watching it, but looking back, so that's a very valid point.
Yeah, to make that whole relationship, I don't know, more palatable or something. Yeah, that is a bit gross.
Yeah, that's true. It does feel a little bit confusing, I suppose, that he is friends with those boys and that he would change so radically from them.
Yeah, in the way that he speaks, like he wouldn't quite use the same kind of slang that that all of his friends do in that group. And like, surely he would actually, if that's who he's grown up with. And his sister is even a bit more like that.
And like when I think, I don't know, what did it inspire in you as like a young white girl? Like what did it make you feel when you were a kid?
It made me want to dance. I think when I was younger, I was really obsessed with like American and like black culture because we didn't really have too much in British film and TV. There wasn't enough. And then when you watch something like this, it just felt like such a different world. And around the time this film came out, it was 21 years ago, so I would have been 12, 11. Anyway, I was just getting into like music that was a bit more cool, probably not as cool as this. But by the time I had watched it repeatedly up until the age of probably 13, this was like the type of music that I was getting into. So what it inspired me was that I wanted to dance and follow my dreams, but also that I really wanted to know more about this world, which just felt so different from, yeah, what I was experiencing in the UK, but also in British films and TV.
Yeah, I have to agree. I felt like I want to chase my dreams and anything is possible. But like when you actually look at that, and the way that that comes across in this film, it's like she doesn't go to Juilliard and she goes to this school. You know, it's anything but where she wants to be. And then she like finally gets to go to Juilliard. And like, I don't know, I just feel like a girl our age who was black who watched this would be like, what is this mean for me?
That's so true. Because she, yeah, that's kind of like... It's kind of like played out as her downfall in a way, that she gets sent there and that she's having to like get out.
And all of her friends are like, ugh.
What does that mean for all of the friends that she's made there? That's so true. That's...
Yeah. Even though there's all this representation, like when you're watching it, there's no inspiring kind of like message, you know?
I feel like if it was made today, there'd be a lot of things that would be changed, but she probably would not want to go to this like stuffy institution in the end. Like she would have seen some other parts of society and would have thought, you know what, this is not for me. I don't want to go to this place with a stuck up man judging my every move.
So she does her dance and she goes to the contemporary bit. And I just thought that when Derek comes up on stage and goes like, no, like you can do this, like you can do it. He basically says, like, forget about him. Do it for me. Like, I'm the only person in this room that's watching you. And I was in my head, I was like, do it for yourself. And then, like, as I said that in my head, he was like, do it for me. And I was like, no.
That is so weird that you say that, because when Warren was dipping in and out was that last, like, last bit, which is obviously the most important bit for you to watch if you've not seen it. Like, out of context, you know, just that on its own. And he was going, I bet you I can tell you what they're going to say next. And like, he was saying like, you can do it. Wait. And he knew what they were going to say every time. But do it for me is like, yeah, much more of the time.
I didn't even pick up on that. I feel like disappointed with myself for not picking up on that.
It was just so funny. Oh yeah. It was just like the perfect thing. Just do it like I'm the only person in this room.
Can I ask a question? I think I missed, and obviously missed the several other times that I've watched it. Why does he start teaching her how to dance?
I was just about to say that. I also missed this and was like, why? What's his interest there?
I didn't ask myself that question at the time, but I'm trying to trace like the conversation where she expresses that she needs to like dance differently, or where he expresses that she needs to dance differently, but it just ends up happening.
Yeah, because they're like in the club, it's like obvious that she can't dance, and then he walks her home, and then they're like, should we hook up sometime, he says, which I was like, ooh. And then they just met up and started dancing, and I was like, that was random.
It feels so formal as well. He like hires a space, and you know, I don't know.
Yeah, they wanted their dirty dancing, tickly armpit scene. No, I just have such fond memories of this film. And, like, I just thoroughly enjoyed it. But, like, when I'm actually unpacking it, I'm like, there's just too many... I can't keep defending it.
But I have to say, all of these things... there were a lot of things I was like, ooh, oh, God, a lot of the way through. However, it was an easy watch, maybe massively because of the soundtrack, also because of Kerry Washington. I think was just brilliant. Like, it was still an enjoyable watch, but maybe that's because they know all the techniques and they're just pulling us in.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Now, it's time for In the Club.
Welcome back. It's time for our In the Club part of Frank Film Club, where we have a special guest. This week, we've got Mitchell Lieb, who is a 45-year music industry veteran. He enjoyed a 30-year-plus career at Disney Studios, where he oversaw the music and soundtrack production for many films, including Pirates of the Caribbean, the live-action Lion King. I have looked at your IMDb page, and I swear you've worked on all of the films that I watched when I was growing up. I reference, I'm kind of embarrassed about it, Princess Diaries all the time. You worked on both of those. Parent Trap, Zoolander, Freaky Friday, Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on here today.
Oh, it's fantastic to be with you all. And I love talking about movies and I love talking about music and films. And I've been doing it my whole life.
Well, I feel like it would be so nice to dive into like your process and how it works. You come on to a film like Save the Last Dance and like, how do you start selecting songs? Is it the same formula every time? Or like, how did that kind of, there's so many killer records on it. So yeah, how does that work for you?
You know, it's never the same process. When I finally saw Save the Last Dance, it was at a pretty, you know, I'll say it was at an advanced stage in the sense that it had been shot. They were planning on doing reshoots. And, you know, at that stage in a movie, you kind of see what works and you see what doesn't work. And there was a music supervisor on the film that was still kind of coming from a place of we've got to make it cooler and we should be doing all new songs. And I looked at it really from a perspective of what works and what doesn't work. And like, who cares that it was, we're talking about a compilation. And more importantly, you're talking about playability of the movie. First, the movie's got to work. Then you produce with playability in mind. You produce with marketing in mind, and you produce with monetization of the assets in mind. So for me, I dove in, I looked at that in this case on that kind of picture, which isn't one I music supervised, it's one I produced the soundtrack to. I came in and funded the sound. I put up $1 million to fund the soundtrack and kind of took the thing over and said, first, let's look at what's working. Montel's song works, this works here, this works here, this works here. This isn't very good, this isn't very good, this isn't very good, this isn't very good. And I need some singles. I need to create some songs and some tracks with some popular artists that are exclusive to my soundtrack. You know, when you're a record producer or a label, you know, you're creating original songs and signing artists and making videos. You have no idea if anybody's gonna play them. Like, that's the whole game. That's the whole game. How do I get it on radio? Who do I have to pay to get it on radio, at least to get it out there to see if the fans really respond to it? But you got to get it added to the playlist to begin with. So now all of a sudden, I'm like the king. I got MTV, and like, I cut that track with Casey and JoJo, and I took Fredro's Star from the movie who walked into my office and said, I have this idea for a song where he had sampled Cyndi Lauper's True Colors. And it was this beautiful thing about the colors of life and the rainbows of life. And it's an interracial love story. And I'm like, oh my God, this is like fucking perfect. And we got Jill Scott to kind of guest on it. And so that was really my process on this particular film. Seeing a film that's almost done and they're still willing to change it, it makes it really... probably not a good choice of word when I say easy, but it certainly makes it easier to know what works and what doesn't work. And so that was really my kind of process on that particular film.
I feel like when I've been looking at reviews of this film, since having rewatched it, everyone says that it's like the best soundtrack and everyone talks about the soundtrack. And like, so was it, is that always the process that you'll come in at that kind of late stage and they'll have a load of songs chosen and then you're kind of like finalizing or swapping a few in? And then, yeah, because I feel like a lot of people don't fully understand what a soundtrack producer does, like myself included, on like such big scale movies like that.
I've been very fortunate to play many of the different critical roles that goes into creating music for movies. From a music supervisor standpoint, which is the one who gets in from the very beginning with the director and looks at every musical moment in the movie. From a soundtrack producer standpoint, there is no set entry point. So the first thing is the mentality of a soundtrack producer is ultimately twofold. Number one, it's creative. Number two, it's monetizing the music asset. Anybody who's going to be working on a film as a soundtrack producer or certainly a label executive is going to be secretly thinking about down the line and how am I going to sell soundtracks. The music supervisor is only thinking about how am I going to support my filmmakers in making this movie. So I'm one of those that's thinking about it all. Certainly if you're putting musical performance numbers on camera or dance numbers on camera, those musical moments tend to sink in more to the audience and they carry them with them and they become more critically important to the play of the film, which then relates to having that much more of a bond to the music, and that relates to wanting to buy that compilation that much more. The soundtrack producer may still enter a project at the very beginning, depending on what needs to be created to facilitate the filming, okay? Or they may come in at a stage where kind of the movie's done and they're really looking to figure out, okay, now how are we going to create songs and drop them into this movie that's already filmed? And then they may even come on later and down the line, like some movies that I've entered where I'm the financer, I'm coming in with the soundtrack money and this layer of music marketing that's going to complement the overall film marketing campaign. And because of my experience as a music supervisor as well, I think the projects that I got involved with always benefited from that amount of experience as well, as opposed to just a soundtrack producer who doesn't have that experience and is being more tossed around with the stream of what everybody's ambitions are for the movie and is just only singularly trying to put together a record or produce one song or something like that.
Let's talk about budget. We're really interested in how you work with budget and, yeah, how much of your creative freedom is subject to that budget.
The film studio head of music is sitting there with a budget and being beaten on by the creative execs and the producers and the head of the studio because all of the departments are over budget. You know how it works. They budget a film, they're working off the script, they're starting moving into production, and it's like, visual effects is over, casting's over, music's over, everything's over. And so when I come in from the outside as a record company with a big checkbook, that head of music is thinking, oh, fucking great. I get Mitch to come in He puts up $1 million. You know, I spent fucking $2 million on Zoolander. Okay? Like, so that head of music is like, oh, bitchin', Mitch is stepping up. I'll be able to complement my music budget with his $1 million or $2 million. I'll take any of the budget that I have for songs, and I'll put it back into score so I can hire Hans Zimmer or James Newton Howard or Elfman or whoever, and I'll make Mitch pay for everything related to, so all this is like godsend, you know. But the money that I'm spending, I do sit back and say, okay, well, what do I want to pay for Save the Last Dance? Well, how many records do I think I can sell? Yeah, so budgets are, that's how I approach budgets. If I'm the head of music, I usually tried to budget appropriately for what I needed. I always went over budget, but, you know, as president of music, I got to approve my own overages. I didn't really necessarily have to go ask for it anymore. They would find out about it later and call me up and go, holy shit, you spent $1 million more? You went over $1 million? I'm like, yeah, this is why.
And, of the many pictures that you have on your credits, why was Save the Last Dance such a fun project for you to work on? What set it apart?
You know, Maisie, everything's about time and place. You know, the moment. It was an important time in my life. I was really trying to prove something. It was just kind of a critical time for me, and you know, it basically was a number one record. And, you know, I think I sold 250,000 soundtracks the first week. I think it went on to do close to 4 million, which, you know, for Disney, for that record company, was huge. And I loved the experience. I also love being the outlier. I love the fact that everybody in town, and I'm telling you, every record company in town had passed on Save the Last Dance. You know, some of my Disney education, for me, that which makes something not so cool is oftentimes what makes it broadly commercial. I looked at the trailer and said, I'm in, and then went off and had a huge success with it. I love that. That's more important. Everybody expects me to have a giant, you know, I'm getting Kendrick Lamar for Black Panther. Everybody expects that to be gigantic. You know, I'm getting John Legend and Ariana Grande for Beauty and the Beast. Everybody expects that to be huge. You're just trying to keep up with it. Yeah, so I think that's why Save the Last Dance really, Maisie, meant so much to me, and still to this day. It's just one of those, my favorite projects. Some of my favorite projects that I've ever worked on that really in my heart are some of my favorites are some of the smallest films. You know, they're not the big ones. The big ones, stress, expectation. The little ones, you want to be that little train that can. And I love that because I'm an outlier personality. You know, given that I shared my story about not taking a traditional path to get to where I've gotten in life. You know.
Well, I guess on that to wrap up, for people who would love to get into the music side of the film industry and like aspire to be a music supervisor or a soundtrack producer, what would be your top tip for them?
Be inventive. You know, you have to create opportunities where there are none. I think the wonderful thing about what's going on in our industry right now is with streaming, there is such a demand and need for so much more content than ever before. The movie business that I grew up in was an extremely exclusive business where there were only so many movies a year. There's only so many weeks, only so many weekends, only so many premiere weekends is the business that I really came up in. And putting aside the fact that so much of that content is faceless, I think what it does do is create a ton of opportunity for everybody, music supervisors, editors, casting people. So for the person who wants to get into music supervising and doesn't know anybody and can't, you know, look, I mean, I always say take that route of, you know, if you're in college and you're into it or you're out or, you know, go find the indie filmmaker, go find the student filmmaker. You know, I would always encourage the person who's trying to get in, don't get too caught up in the size and the scale of what you're doing. Go refine your craft, go get some experience, get in there. And that little nobody filmmaker who's doing the student film today is going to be hired by Netflix to do a movie tomorrow. And what you want to do is get in the stream with those people, get in the stream with that director, get in the stream with those producers. They're going to be the producers of tomorrow in the biggest of ways, because that's what all of that business is looking for. They're looking for those student filmmakers. They're looking for those shining, you know, diamonds in the rough. And I think that the music supervisor who wants to get into that should really kind of do the same thing. If you're not tough-skinned and you're really not going to live and die for it and be willing to work 24/7 for it, maybe you should be thinking about something else. But you got to throw yourself in 100%. You got to really chase it, and all of your strategy and focus needs to be on that. But I would say for anybody with ambition who's just trying to get into it, start small and learn.
Well, thank you so much, Mitchell.
Mitchell, it's been so great to chat with you.
So good.
You are welcome.
I feel like I've learned a lot about how it all works. And it's just so nice that we're all so passionate about what we do. You're so right. You have to find what that is. And it's just such a joy to meet somebody who's had the career that you've had and still be so passionate about something you did 21 years ago. Like, I hope for me, in my career, I'm going to have the same experience.
What a chat.
Absolutely. So interesting to chat with someone with this much experience in the industry and have learned so much about soundtrack producing.
Yeah, and it's so nice to hear somebody who is so big in the game and has so much experience speak so passionately about what they do. I learned loads.
Yeah, same. So, what were your final thoughts on the film?
Well, I think it was really good to break this movie down with you guys. I think that I said at the beginning of this episode that if I watch it now, I think it was a bad film. But I feel like that came off a little bit harsh. I think that, like, there's things that would be done differently. But of the time, I do think that it was special. And it's part of my origin story, so can't be that bad.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. It is an absolute classic. I'm really glad I rewatched it again. I really don't think I would have watched it again ever in my life unless I was directed to do so by Lowry Roberts this week. So thanks for that. I'm really glad I watched it with my boyfriend as well, just to see his face cringing over the dancing. And yeah, I think there's things that don't hold up very great today in our standards, but it is classic and I like it.
Yeah, agree with all of those comments. And I think to add to those, I think it is useful to watch a film like this that does have its problems, because it's then great to know that we are learning.
Yeah, and I also really appreciated Hannah said it shows how far we've come. And it's like not very often that we say that, because we always, you know, acknowledge how far we've still got to go. And I think when you watch a movie like this, you're like, actually, we've done a bit in 20 years. And I think, yeah, sometimes good to see that.
Well, there's obviously a lot of problems with this film, but there's no denying that it did have a positive impact at the time.
Yeah.
And like so many people saw it. Oh, anyone guesses on the budget?
Ooh, five.
20.
$13 million.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And any guesses on the how it did in box office worldwide?
I do know this one, so I'm not going to say it, but Hannah, you should
say
it.
Oh, no, say it.
I didn't mean to.
Oh, I'm not good with numbers, girls. I don't know.
Yeah, to be honest, I wouldn't usually know, but it was nearly 10 times the budget, so it was $122 million.
Cool.
Which actually, this is something maybe I need to be doing more research on, because I don't know how that compares to other things.
Like, so many films barely make back what they spent. That is unreal. That's why we got a step up to the streets and a step up 3D and a step up 4 and then a step up spin-off TV show. It's because of that. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, then make sure you give us a 5-star rating on wherever it is that you listen to your podcast, because it really, really helps us. Next week, we're going to be watching the incredible film Censor, which is directed by Prano Bailey Bond, and it came out in 2021 and is available to watch on Mubi right now and also on Amazon. So make sure you go and have a watch of that and then meet us back here next week for more Frank Film Club. I also wanted to give a little message to anyone who is listening from London or near London. We are lucky enough to be doing some in-person events very, very soon in the city. And if you want to be in with a shot of being there, then make sure you send us an email saying, I want to be there, to filmclub@rap.world. And you can also message us on Instagram, which is @frankfilmclub. And you can be in with a shot of joining us for our live episode. So give us a message if you're in or near London, and then we'll see you next week for Censor and for more Frank Film Club. Bye-bye.
This podcast was presented by Wrapped.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.